Have you ever tried to train a dog not to jump on people or maybe to stay close to you on a walk? It's not always easy, and sometimes it might feel downright impossible. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're going to learn about the fascinating world of working dogs and the people who are able to teach them to do complex and important work. And one of those people is Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist and author of several books. She's been a guest on the show so many times. Always great to have her with us. Patricia, thank you so much for coming.
Oh, it's great fun to be here.
With us by phone today, Kat Warren, who is an associate professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science, journalism, editing, and reporting. And she is, I would like to have her as a teacher. She's a really good writer, and she's written a good book here. It's called What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. And Kat, thanks so much for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Larry. It's a really honor to be here with Patricia and with you today. Thanks.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you're ever thinking about changing universities, I'm also a professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication.
A little bit of science writing goes on there, Kat.
A little bit of science writing.
Just a little.
And gosh, the weather is so nice here.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I was pleased that our classes were canceled today here because we might get a dusting of snow. I think it's a little more serious out your way.
We're the 35 below type, so then they think about closing school. Oh, my goodness. Well, What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. What a wonderful book. Thank you so much for writing it and sharing it with us. And maybe you can just tell our listeners what your book's about. What's the working dog that you have? It's a really cool one.
Well, you know, all dog stories start with a particular dog, and the particular dog this one begins with was a German Shepherd that we got more than 9.5 years ago, and he was an impossible little jackass when he arrived. And you know, Patricia knows well how it's those kinds of dogs who end up really changing you. And he was a singleton, and he didn't have other pups in his litter, and it made him a little bit emotionally stunted with other dogs. And he came into our life with lots of drive and lots of issues with other dogs and other pups, and he became a cadaver dog.
Yeah.
Simply a dog that's able to smell human dead bodies and help people find them.
He was a special kind of dog, as you just described, but why did you land on a cadaver dog or training him for that?
It was accidental. It was really an issue where I took him to a trainer whom I really respected, and she had done search and rescue work, and I knew about her search and rescue work, and I took him to her when he was about 4.5 months old and said, "God, Nancy, what the heck am I going to do?" And she said, "Why don't you train him as a cadaver dog?" And of course I said, "What's that?" And mm-hmm. she explained. And she told me later, she admitted that she never thought I would take her seriously.
Huh?
She said she was just trying to distract me. But I did take it seriously. And in a way, that's what the book is about. It's that journey that this big, smart, sometimes obnoxious dog took me on.
Yeah. Patricia, I know you wanted to add something.
Yeah, there. One of the things I find so interesting about the story is and so compelling is that Kat and her trainer work so hard to find the right thing for her and this dog, you know? And,
yeah.
And don't you think that's, for those of us who think of our dogs as family and friends and sentient, interesting, intelligent mm-hmm. creatures and want a really strong relationship with them, that's really part of the key, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
It's trying to figure out where the right place is for the two of you. Over the 20+ 5 years or so that I've seen clients, I saw so many who were trying to put a dog, you know, a round dog in a square slot, or whose dog really, 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 really was great at something, But they didn't really like doing it. And so I love that you settled on Cadaver Dog, of all things. It leads to, it's just a fascinating story. It's certainly not something that all of us are going to be doing, probably, over the weekend. But
no.
What an amazing world that brought you into, Kat.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was an amazing world, and I still feel lucky because I'm still in that world thanks to Solo. And you're so right, Patricia, because, of course, now I have a new pup who is so different from Solo, and I'm trying to train her as a cadaver dog, and she has a lot of what it takes, and yet I'm using a completely different timetable and a completely different way of training her because she is a different dog.
Yeah, you know? Way different. Do you know Susanna Charlson by any chance, Kat? Is she?
I do. And, you know, I think her book,
Center of the Missing,
was just excellent. I had some students read it. I think it's a great depiction of search and rescue work.
I think one of the things that struck me, because I interviewed Susanna few years back now about the book, but the sort of the training and the work that goes into the search and rescue dog is very similar in many ways to what you had to go through with yours.
Yes. Yes, and her dog is actually, Pumpkin is cross-purpose. So he both does air scenting, finding people who are missing and still alive, and the dead. Some dogs can do that. Yeah. And I think that what that book captures for people is that it's an enormously demanding discipline once you start. And I think Susanna did a beautiful job of showing the kind of dedication that search and rescue personnel have.
Yeah. Well, that certainly comes out in your book as well, does it not, Patricia?
Yeah, you know, the thing that's striking me right now is one, as you're both saying, how much work it is to train a really good search and rescue dog or a good cadaver dog, or, you know, for that matter, a good bomb sniffing dog or a good, you know, drug dog. There's an incredible amount of work. I think, well, extra with search and rescue and cadaver, because you're talking about, you know, you're not talking about focusing on, is there something in those suitcases and pointing at them to the dog. You're talking about 500 square miles.
Yeah.
You know? But the other thing I wanted to say that I love about this, one of the things I love about Scent of the Missing and What the Dog Knows, is that it opens up this whole world to all of the rest of us dog lovers, about the world of scent and the world of our dogs, the world that the dog, quote, sees.
Yeah.
I'm putting quote marks with my fingers because we're primates, right? We see everything. We're so visual. And to start to really get it pounded into our heads that there's an entire reality that we just miss, although not quite as much as we consciously know, but there's so many things that are not complicated and relatively simple that dog owners, every dog owner can do related to their dog's nose and scent. Particularly helpful, by the way, in this weather. You know, so I was playing nose games with Willie last night because I didn't want to go out. This is too miserably cold. So I just taught him find it. I just hide something and then he uses his nose to find it, and he loves it. And Kat, I would love to hear you talk about how fun it is to watch a dog discover that they can work as a partner with you and they can use their nose, and how fun it is.
Yeah.
You know, it is such a joy to watch a dog use his or her nose. And one of the things, and you're absolutely right, Patricia, is like exercising Willie inside where he's using not only his nose but his brain inside a space of a house where you would think, well, that's not going to tire him out. And yet, when a dog is sniffing, he's essentially hyperventilating for one thing, and for another, he's really using his brain. And I think that Cindy Otto made this point really nicely, too, from Penn Vet Working Center, where she talked about kind of the extra happiness of dogs that get cognitively challenged, right? No matter whether they're pets or working dogs, that just being able to do that work. And for me, watching a dog work is not only getting to watch the dog, but it's sort of understanding how air moves in outside. You know, you can play with colored smoke bombs and start to get an idea. And early on with Solo, Nancy handed me a handful of those colored smoke bombs and and had me light them up in various places under various conditions. And you go, oh, my God, look how that smoke is just crawling up the side of that building and then curling over on itself, right? And then when you have an experienced dog that can sketch that for you in a way, the dog can really draw a picture for you of this world that's invisible to us. And and that's why it's so fun to watch them.
Do you know where you get colored smoke bombs? Seriously? Seriously, how fun is that?
That sounds like
you know,
a lot of fun.
Patricia, it's a Nancy Hook and Mike Baker secret. Actually, I think you can get them in a lot of different places.
I'll Google colored smoke bombs.
Google because that you know they're not fireworks.
Yeah.
Mike has used them as for his law enforcement green handlers to show them because they really it's hard to understand that the scent is not next to the object always, right?
That's
the
right.
Scent can be over to the side or far away or hunkered down over the water.
I haven't.
Right? The dog is not wrong going over to the water and sniffing the water.
I have a video on my blog. You may have some too, Kat. I don't know, of Willie searching for a toy that we can see.
Mm-hmm.
We can see it, but it's red and it's in grass, and dogs are red, green, and colorblind, so he can't really see it. And so watching him, Larry, it's so interesting. Watching him follow the scent, which the air is taking away from the object, watching him follow this envelope of scent as it flows sort of through the environment, it's just, and then eventually finally sort of tracking it back to the object, it's fascinating. And my favorite story is actually from Steve White, who is a police dog trainer, great dog trainer. But he tells a story of teaching a new young dog who is searching for a supposed perpetrator, right? So he's searching for an escaped convict or something. So the guy has run into a big warehouse, and the dog and the handler track it to the door of this big, huge, massive, empty warehouse, basically. And the dog looks up at a particular area and goes, burr, like that's where the dangerous person is. And then a voice from behind them goes, over here. and the story is, and Kat, you can explain this way better than I, but the story is that there was more concentration of scent in the other corner because of air currents and heat cold than actually were at the man. Does that make sense, Kat?
Yes, it makes absolute sense. And especially, you know, when a dog comes in, that air can concentrate. And I've seen so many dogs just try to climb a wall. Right?
You write about that in your book. The Searching the Swamp, I think that chapter, you write about how Solo suddenly was up on the hind legs, kind of.
Yeah, yes, yes. And, you know, the scent had gone up, and, you know, the moisture can kind of concentrate scent or in vegetation in ways that still isn't entirely fully understood, but and so, you know, he was absolutely right, and especially since the victim had been out for a few days, right? And scent has a chance to do all sorts of things over a period of days. One of the great handlers and trainers up in Maine, who does wilderness searching, has done presentations. Her name is Deborah Pullman, showing how scent can travel for like a mile and a quarter, right? And the dogs can get it.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, man. Well, Kat Warren and Patricia McConnell, our guests today, we're talking with them about the art and science of working dogs. Kat has authored a wonderful book. It's called What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. Great to have them along. Patricia, of course, certified applied animal behaviorist. Kat, associate professor at NC State University, where she teaches science journalism, among other things. And her book, What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. You may have a question or a comment or an experience to share. Do you have a working dog? What types of tasks does your dog do? I'm Larry Mueller. Rob and Cherry, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you'll stay tuned because at 11:45, we'll take a look at human behavior and specifically how you and I can successfully keep off weight that we've lost. But right now, we're talking with Patricia McConnell and Kat Warren about dog behavior, training working dogs, the art and science with them both. Kat just authored What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. Great to have both of them with us. And certainly, if you have an experience, a question, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And let's take a call or two here. Bill in Orfordville, turn to you. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you, Larry. We raised some Lloyds, and they're a mushing dog as well as a herding dog. And they use their noses to find the trail when you're running your dog sled team, for instance.
Yep.
You know, dog sled teams have no reins or that sort of thing. So the lead dog has to take you safely across the territory, and he uses her nose for that. They were the first dogs used in the Arctic explorations because of that sort of thing. The other thing is they're using these dogs as nose right now in research for cancer detection.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. Patricia, I'll maybe comment to you from you first and then to Kat.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because there are so many things we're doing with the skills of a dog's nose right now from cancer detection. There are some dogs who can be trained to detect for signs of cancer in urine, for example. Interestingly enough, by the way, those dogs were just pet dogs. They were not dogs either bred to be scent detectors or who had a lot of training. And I want to circle back to that a little bit later because the issue mm-hmm. of training and scent detection, I think, is really important. But also there are dogs, for example, who are trained to find tortoise poop in Nevada. Mm-hmm. there's endangered species of tortoise that people are trying to track. And the best way to find it is to put a dog out there and ask it to try and find it. There are dogs literally all over the world right now who are using their noses for our benefit. And the range of abilities, I don't think we've even begun to tap the use for these dogs. Kat, I'm sure you know a lot more about this than I do.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not sure, Patricia, you know an awful lot. And what is interesting about the caller's comment about his dogs as mushers is that, you know, my book concentrates a lot sort of on the dog's nose and goes out from there. But if you think about it, all of these working dogs, whether they're mushers or herders or law enforcement dogs, you know, that are detecting drugs, they're using a variety of skills, right? Not just their noses, or not just in the case of the musher dogs, not just their strength and ability to run, right? They always put this stuff together. And so one of the things that I'm kind of fascinated with in terms of what you, Patricia, you say about sort of the what dogs are being used for is that we do have these dogs that are going out and finding scat, for instance, in Canada, of wolves and caribou to try to track those populations around the oil sands areas. And, you know, those dogs have to be out in extreme conditions all day long. So not only are they using their noses, but they're using all sorts of, you know, their physical prowess and ability to cover territory and everything else. And it just always reminds me that no matter what the dog's task is, part of it is that they're bringing all of themselves to it. And then, of course, the handler, which I think people inevitably, it's easy for us to forget because we love dogs so much that it is such a 50-50 proposition.
Yeah, yeah. Bill, you had some.
And Patricia knows that, too, I know.
So true. Absolutely.
Yeah. I was just going to add one more thing about the being able to combine different kinds of skills, these dogs. My wife just walks in the door looking like Seneca the North with our new puppy, and this little dog has been out in his 35 and 40 below the weather, and it doesn't even bother it hardly, as long as you take care of it. And these dogs are extremely hardy and will work with you out there. When I go to feed the sheep and things, they're out there with me, and it's just amazing. And they develop a team work with you. They know the patterns of the farm. They know the time we should be doing this and the time we should be doing that.
You know, it's a partnership, isn't it, Patricia?
Oh, it's so true. And, you know, sort of along those lines, but riffing off something Kat said earlier, one of the things that I was fascinated by in What the Dog Knows was Kat talking about how interesting it is that people have assumed that dogs don't need training to use their nose really, really, really well, which is, when you think about it, sort of ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the fact of the matter is that just as people can be trained to discriminate between scents and get better and better and better at it, and some people are inherently better than others, but the same is true with dogs. And she makes just such a good point that people sort of assume that any dog at any time is brilliant at detecting odors or searching out for them. And the fact of the matter is they can improve profoundly through training experience. And it's not sort of fair to ask them I guess the best example is there's some experiments where people have asked, well, like, how, you know, what can dogs discriminate? What can they detect? And yet they're basically asking people who've never been, I don't know, in an airplane to fly a fighter jet for the first time without any training.
It is a nice analogy that a researcher who's now down in New Zealand, Deke Helton, made about you don't like expect a student to fly an airplane, but all the time researchers are bringing pet dogs into their labs, asking them to do a task, and then coming to a conclusion if the dog can't do that task, that a dog is not capable of doing that task. And I think the prettiest little study that was done is that the Brits had gotten pretty far, and they had showed that dogs could detect the difference between identical twins, but not if the twins lived in the same house and ate the same diet. And so the researcher said, that's the end of it, right? Dogs can't detect the difference between those identical twins. Well, some Czech researchers in 2011 took essentially law enforcement dogs that had been trained, and those dogs had no problem detecting the difference between identical twins who lived together and ate the same diet, right, and distinguishing their scent. And once again, I think it's a perfect little thing of saying, you know, it isn't fair to show that somebody with no training can't do something.
Yeah.
Right.
John in Richland Center has something that kind of relates to what we're talking about here. John, hi.
Hi, Larry. I was going to ask your guests, I was told one time that a dog's nose is 10 times more sensitive than a man's, but it might be more. Can you tell me how strong it is?
Mm-hmm. Shall
ahead,
I
Kat.
Take that one?
Yeah, go ahead, Kat.
Patricia?
Oh, absolutely. Take it and run, Kat.
Well, here it is. Nobody knows. And we have all sorts of analogies, up to one that I found on Animal Planet, was that the bloodhound nose was a million times more sensitive than the human nose. And we're not even sure how good the human nose is. And so not only do we not have good studies showing how good a bloodhound nose is compared to, say, you know, a Pekingese's nose, we actually don't have those studies. We actually don't have good comparative studies. So it's really a work in progress. And in a way, Larry Myers, who's at Auburn and a great sort of a sniffer dog researcher, did a few informal experiments where he showed that there were certain scents that his lab workers were better at detecting than the dogs in the lab.
Uh-huh.
So what we do know is that human noses are a lot better than we think they are,
mm-hmm.
and that we really still don't know. The dog's nose is still a bit of a black box, and so, you know, it's much more wonderfully complicated than it is sometimes portrayed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a short answer. It's and I'll stop there.
Patricia wants to start, though. So let's
I'm raising my finger up, Larry, like raising my hand. Can I talk now, teacher? No, but what you made me think of, Kat, there's so much research out there that, as you say, suggests that we indeed are better at detecting scents than we think we are. And some of it is unconscious. There's an old study, it's been around a really long time, in which mothers of newborns were asked to identify the T-shirt of their own infant out of 9 others. So they were given 10 mm-hmm. T-shirts to sniff. And the mothers basically said, I couldn't possibly do that. But just, you know, no harm, no foul, give it a try. And it turned out that more often than not, they were right. There's other evidence that, for example, I love this one. Males who have an opportunity to be in close physical contact with females, their beards grow faster. And it turns out that their beards grow faster because of a particular scent of a woman. So I don't. I love that.
Isn't there a movie about that?
Yeah, exactly.
There is indeed.
Exactly. I think I love
and
the power.
There's a little study done about 13 years ago, where dog owners could distinguish their dog's scent off a blanket.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things I love about. And I think about it when I travel that I love about Willie is I know the scent of the top of his head. I mean, I know exactly what that dog smells like, and I love it. I love his scent. And so, you know, I think we are actually better, as Kat said, at using our nose than we think we are. But nonetheless, it's nothing comparable to a dog.
No, it's that this is true.
Give us an example of from your book. There's such a great... it's such a great book, and how you trained and how you worked with Solo. Give us a flavor so people understand what it's like to train a dog to do the kind of work, the cadaver work that you do with.
Sure. Well, I mean, what you're doing with a cadaver dog is, you know, human decomposition is pretty complicated. There's a lot of volatiles that come off us when we die. About 480 different ones so far have been identified. And all I do with Solo is I put out samples, or somebody I don't who's working with me will hide samples of, for instance, dirt that's come from underneath a decomposing body, or a few teeth, or blood off of bandages. And Solo's job is, after those have been hidden and, you know, maybe are out there for a couple of hours, we call it cooking, but I suppose that
ouch.
The analogy wouldn't please everybody. but you say that for drugs too. So a scent cone, and Patricia talked about the envelope, right? An envelope or a scent cone where the volatiles come off that and drift up or over or into, and you send the dog out to find it, and the dog works. You've seen hunting dogs that mm-hmm. quarter back and forth, right? Air scent dog will do the same thing, is that Solo will come out and he'll zigzag back and forth. And once he catches the edge of a scent, then he'll go in until he catches the outer edge. And so if you would imagine an ice cream cone with the source of the scent at the point of the sugar cone and the dog going in, he just bounces back and forth against the outer edges of that scent until he narrows it down. ideally at the source of the scent, and then he lies down. And when he lies down, that's the signal that he has gotten as close as he thinks he can to that scent, and that's the strongest point of the scent.
Mm.
Different states, you train dogs differently, partly depending on what the laws of that state are about keeping training samples, right? And they differ from state to state. North Carolina has somewhat liberal laws, but there are limits. And so one of the things we always do is I try to train him as frequently as possible. We actually have a research facility, an anthropological research facility up in the corner of the state that's it's colloquially known as a body farm, where the dogs get a chance to actually be exposed to whole bodies, people who have donated their bodies to science. It's a great opportunity for the dogs.
Yeah, I've actually trying to think of the author or the woman who wrote writes mysteries that at least
so
one
Patricia
of them
Cornwell.
Patricia Cornwell.
Patricia Cornwell did wet. Yes, and Bill Bass. Who is the founder of University of Tennessee's body farm, has written several mysteries, too, based on his work there.
Do you have videos up on your site, your website?
I do. I actually have a couple of videos of Solo working, and it's catwarren.com, and you can see him during a training. Of course, you have to realize that once you put the cameras there, it's not actually like real life. But
yeah.
Solo's pretty good at ignoring cameras. So,
yeah. So
I haven't seen those yet. I can't wait to. I have a video on my website in the reading room, Larry. I can send you the link for your website. But it's an untrained dog. Well, I shouldn't say untrained, but basically, he was trained in the most casual of ways, and he's just running around. He's running around my front yard looking for a toy that I've basically hidden from him. I would love later you and I can be in a conversation. I would love you to watch it and tell me what you're seeing. But again, I just want to emphasize this is something anybody can do. You can teach your dog, get an object that's of interest. Maybe it has some food smeared onto it. Cat can probably tell you better how to do this. But basically, you can make it really simple. Just put it not very far away and just say, find it. They go to get it. They get a treat or they get to lick the treats outside of it. And then gradually put it farther and farther away. Willie's cue is find it. And I actually taught him to use his nose because he's so visual. He's a border collie, herding dog, right? So he'd look for things. And I actually taught him sniff, sniff. So I would just hold my hand out to him. Every dog wants to sniff your hand when you come in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I just say sniff, sniff. So I literally say sniff, sniff, meaning no, don't use your eyes, use your nose. And then he'll go to do that. Anyway, so anybody can do this, right, Kat?
Absolutely.
Not cadaver dogs. Search and rescue.
The fact is that dogs love to use their noses. I mean, we know that. We know how much they like our crotches if they're not properly trained. and 9 times out of 10, I mean, I know very few dogs where you cannot build their by doing these simple games. And how do you interest them? It depends on who the dog is and what toy the dog likes. Solo is very funny because he will actually go search for any toy by name, and he's got probably about 12. My new pup, Coda, is learning the names of toys. But what Solo will do is if she's having a hard time finding it, he'll look at me and he'll go over to where it's hidden, and he'll look pointedly at it and sometimes hit it with his paw and then stand back to let her go get it.
Oh, my goodness.
I want to see a video of that.
It's just like, I thought, my God, this dog has grown up because this was not the dog I had for the first few years. But it's a kind of generosity and that sort of like, I know this isn't my game. I know this is her. But, oh, my God, she's dumb.
Oh, man. Well, this is great. Your stories, the stories that you tell, too, about your searches are, and wonderful is not the right word.
Yeah, this is dramatic
stuff. Very dramatic.
You know, the
really interesting.
The blurb I wrote was "Move over CSI and make way for Kat Warren and her forensic dog Solo." One of the things I wonder about Kat when reading this is, you're looking for people who might have been killed, who might have been lost and died. How do you deal with the drama and the hardship of this?
Yes.
This is really dramatic
Great
stuff
question.
You do.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I mean, it's an interesting question. And I have to say, you know, as you've read the book, and so you know that there are so many other people who are so much more experienced than I am at this work. And I write a lot about them as well. And, you know, I'm a relative newcomer. What I will say, and I think that what most search people will say, is that you are working so hard to get your portion of the search right, because it's a huge team, right, that
yeah.
comes in. You're working so hard to make sure that your dog has a good time and that you're reading the wind correctly and trying to cover the area, that the issue of the backstory or the drama or even the possible danger always recedes. And I think that certainly post facto in searches, 3 or 4 days afterwards, I can have some sort of effect from it. I'll think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that during the time I'm doing it, that I so want to let Solo know that this is the most fun game in the world. And once you set yourself up that way, you actually yourself end up inevitably having that affect you.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
Right, and it, so to me, it if it comes afterwards. Any sort of thinking about the sadness. And the second thing is inevitably, when and if we go out because we know that the person is dead. And so for me, it's a recovery operation. And so the tragedy has already happened. And to tell you the truth, that also, as sad as the story may be, puts you in a different mindset, because the fact is that finding somebody represents a success at that point, if that makes sense.
It does. And speaking of successes, your book is certainly a wonderful success, Kat. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Boy, did that time go fast.
It sure did.
Oh, thank you both for having me. And thank you, Patricia, for being such a wonderful author and dog person.
Oh, thank you. This book is, if you haven't read it, all you out there, you want to. It is just brilliantly written and fascinating.
Kat Warren is an associate professor at NC State, North Carolina State University, where she teaches science journalism. She's the author of What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. One of our guests, the other, Patricia McConnell. Thank you, Patricia.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Patricia is certified applied animal behaviorist, author of many books. And we have both, I believe, of their sites up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Patricia, if you want to shoot me something, you were going to shoot me something.
Oh, yeah, I was going to send you an exact link to the video I have of Willie looking for something.
Ah.
But Kat has great videos on her website, too.
Yep, there we go. Thank you both very, very much. It's always fascinating to learn about the behavior of the animals around us. And coming up next, we're going to turn our attention to human behavior a bit more. Losing weight it's hard, but often keeping the weight off long term is really the big challenge. And we're going to learn what people who do that successfully have in common. So it's going to be, I think, a useful show for you, I hope, and for me as well. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.